Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the dancer and choreographer Akram Khan. His on-stage style is daring, exquisite and explosive, combining the intricate mathematical discipline of classical movement with contemporary dance. A compulsive collaborator, he's worked with everyone, from prima ballerina Sylvie Guillem to disco queen Kylie Minogue. Anish Kapoor has built his sets, Anthony Gormley his props. He's never been one for sitting still. As a child of Bengali immigrants, he started learning Indian dance almost as soon as he could walk, and was then plucked from a lacklustre school career to spend 2 years touring the world with Peter Brook's Mahabharata. For 12 years now, he's led his own dance company, who sell out theatres around the globe. He says, "The way I communicate best is through my body. That's my language. And if that's taken away from me, words are not enough." Well, Akram Khan, we hope that for the next little while, at least words will be enough. Give me an idea of the kind of training you do each day.
It's different now to the way I used to train before. I mean, you know, when I was younger, I used to train 8 hours a day. But now I usually train for 3 hours. You know, I put on my belt. It's like a ritual. It's like a prayer for me. It's like brushing your teeth. You get up and you have to do that.
And you say you put on your bells. They're wrapped around your ankles.
Yeah, wrapped around my ankles. And I would train for about an hour and a half to about 3 hours. But the last 6 months has been a very difficult period for me because I had an Achilles tendon rupture. And it's really the first serious injury that I ever had. And the vulnerability there is unbelievable, and I discovered the gym through my physio pushing me to go to the gym, because dancing, training to be a dancer is different to training to be physically fit.
What do they make of you at the gym?
Pretty puny, actually. I mean, I feel quite insecure there. I mean, you know, my thighs are quite muscular, but that's the size of their arms, forearms. So, you know, in ratio, I feel like a tiny, you know, ant.
And you've said that, you know, this is the first time you've really had a proper injury, which is pretty remarkable for a dancer. I'm wondering if it's something to do with... You're in your late 30s, which for a dancer is sort of late middle age, really.
Yeah.
Is it something to do with your age that you got the injury?
No, it's to do with arrogance, I think, really. There comes a point where you start to believe you're indestructible, and I just took the body for granted and my body spoke back. It starts to speak back to you when it starts to hurt.
This injury has come at a particularly inopportune time because you are about to take part in the Olympics opening ceremony for 2012.
Right.
Yeah. So how is... I mean, that must be interfering profoundly with your preparation.
No, I just have to manage around it, really. Danny Boyle has been wonderful. You know, he just asked me straight after. He said, "Do you think you can get back?" And I said, "I can. Do you trust me?" And he said, "Yeah, I do." He's been so supportive.
You're used to performance, of course. You've been performing for many, many years. But the idea of having... What will the global audience be for the Olympics, for the opening ceremony?
We think about 2 billion or more.
Little frisson of nerves about that?
You know, I went to the stadium the other day. It was empty, except Danny and some other choreographers, and it was very awe-inspiring. And I don't know how it's going to be for the audience, but for a performer to stand in a scale where you feel so tiny, it just made me feel very humble.
Time for some music then, Akram Khan. Tell me about the first track we're going to hear today. What is it and why have you chosen it?
It's Michael Jackson, "Don't Stop Till You Get Enough." It's the moment of transformation for me as a child. I was early teens and I remember nobody knew me. I was a very shy person and I couldn't communicate. Words weren't something I was comfortable with, especially around girls. And then there's this disco competition held at school, and my friend said, "Oh, go for it, go for it." And I went up for it, and I did Michael Jackson. And from that day on, everybody knew who Akram Khan was because I won the competition. So it's a very, very important moment for me of kind of realising that my body was my language. It's the first time I discovered my body became my way of communicating.
Oh, That was Michael Jackson and Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Akram Khan, you said going into that you did Michael Jackson at the school dance competition. So what, you were copying every move, were you?
I was very good at imitating. I remember watching Thriller as a child and it just changed my life.
And up until that point then, you had been studying Kathak, which is this very traditional, fairly rigid mathematical form of dance that originated on the Indian subcontinent. And so when you watched Michael Jackson dance, did it kind of flick a switch in you? Did you think, I want to try a bit of that too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Kathak came really because of the push of my mother. You know, I didn't really want to do Kathak. Michael Jackson, nobody had to push me. The music would come on, I'd watch him and I'd just move. And my mum just kind of said, he needs to do this. He needs to dance in some form or another. But she felt classical would give me a base. It would give me a ritual.
And where would you practice dance at home?
I mean, we used to live above my dad's restaurant. So I apologise to all the customers who used to hear banging on the ceiling. Literally, the ceiling was falling apart and my father had to plaster it.
When we think, and we being the sort of ignorant masses, when we think of Indian dancing, of course, we tend to think of those huge, and they are really intoxicating, Bollywood numbers that we see. It's a completely different thing that you're talking about. To the lay person, can you explain the difference of what you would be watching?
Yeah, it's like watching classical ballet as opposed to the kind of pop video that you would see now. Classical has something very spiritual about it. And that's really important for me. And I didn't realise at the time, but I think that's what my mother wanted me to get. Not just the sense of ritual and discipline, but the sense that it's connected to something more beyond yourself.
When I've watched, as I have, little clips of you rehearsing this traditional type of dance, Kathak dancing, there's a sense in which it is interesting. You say it's a spiritual element, a strong spiritual basis to it, because there is something about it that almost looks like you're meditating, even though you're moving.
Yeah. Absolutely. Our teachers were training us to recognize that the space that you enter and you work in is a temple. The Kathak, because of its structure and the precision and the mathematics and the geometrical structures and all the kind of things that go around defining it, for me, in order to find out who I was, I had to master it. To a certain extent. I'm not saying I'm a master, but I had to master it to a certain extent.
How long do people, I mean, typically a Kathak dancer would begin to master it when?
It depends on the person. Right. I mean, you know, there was a whole year when I was, I think, 17, and I wasn't adjusting with school. So I would leave the house in my school uniform and then creep out to the back. My parents would go to work, and I'd climb over my backyard and go into my dad's garage. And I would train in the garage for 10 hours, then get back in my uniform, come back through the front as if I went to school, and that was for a year.
Did nobody notice that you weren't turning up at school?
I was very, very sharp, so I would catch all the mail before they arrived. And then came a mail, but that day my mum was homesick and she got the mail first. So we had to go to parents' evening and I was kind of, you know...
And the mail was, where's your son, was it?
We need to speak to you.
Okay.
In the parents' evening. So they turned up. My parents went up to the teacher and said, we're Akram's parents, we're here to speak to you. And he looked down and said, ah, yes, Akram Khan. I don't even know what he looks like, but I'd love to meet him.
More of that in a second. For now, let's have your second disc of the day. Akram, what are we going to hear now?
Caetano Veloso. It's a soundtrack from Talk to Her.
And why do you like this?
You know, I'm a very physical dancer and animalistic in my dance approach. I've always been. And when I heard the song, I realized that this guy has a fragility that is extremely powerful in his voice. And I was always under the assumption that fragility is something weak. And so this song gave me permission. The way he sings it gave me permission to realize that actually in my dance, I want to search for that sense of fragility.
Dicen que por las noches no más se le iba en puro llorar. Dicen que no comía, no más se le iba en puro tomar. Juran que el mismo cielo se estremecía al oír su llanto.
Caetan Veloso and Cucurucucu Paloma from Pedro Almodovar's film Talk to Her. So, Akram Khan, let's rewind a little bit. We know about you rehearsing in the garage, doing the Kathak dancing for 10 hours a day, but before that, we'll rewind to when you were born. It was 1974. In those early years, it was southwest London that you lived in with your parents. Your parents had come to Britain from Bangladesh a couple of years earlier. Why did they leave?
My parents wanted a better education. And my father had dreams of moving to London and starting a business up. I mean, actually, he came to study accountancy, but he wanted to have his own business. And he felt he could achieve that in the West. And in Bangladesh, it was a real struggle. So, you know, my father came first and then my mother came after. And
so to that extent, things went well because your father was running his own business. He had his own restaurant, but that's really hard work if it's a one-man band.
It is, but he wasn't good at it. You know, in all honesty, bless him, he's done it for 20 years and he's not a people's person. You know, okay. as a restaurant owner, you have to really know how to be with people. My father's not a great communicator. He's full of warmth and love and people like him a lot, but I think he should have gone into politics. He loves politics.
Okay, so he was, I mean, that's interesting and very honest of you to say he wasn't very good at it. Did he come home grumpy every day or why did
you? Yeah, he did because his business was struggling. But you know, he's so determined. He stuck with it for 20 years. In the beginning, first 5 years, it was doing well. And then the last 15 years, it was doing really badly. And he wanted to provide for his family. And so he kept with it.
So what about your mother? What are your early memories of her as a mum?
Oh, she's very special. She's my guide, my spiritual guide, I would say. She was very much into poetry. She went to Dhaka University. She studied language, Bengali language. And when she came here, she just befriended so many people. And she was someone who was open. My father's the opposite. He's closed. He's very protective. My mother is open. In her heart, she's very open. And this gave me a lot of courage because I could have easily have gone my father's way because of the community and the pressure that I had. Because Bangladeshi people are very academic, especially my parents' generation. And they definitely wanted their children to be a lawyer, a doctor. We all know that. And I was kind of pushed to the side a lot in the parties and stuff. So nobody would quite talk to me because, you know, I was more of a dancer, which wasn't really serious or respectable. And so my mother, with her generosity, she always turned the negativity into positivity.
And she had wanted herself at one point as she was growing up to become a dancer. She was interested in dance.
Yeah, she was a huge fan of dance. But it was very unfortunate for her because her father was this great mathematician, I think twice gold medalist. I never met him, but I meet my parents' friends all over the world and they say, oh, I studied with your grandfather. But my grandfather didn't want his children to dance, which was my mother. He felt that it would bring bad reputation to the family and, you know, the daughter shouldn't dance. And so she secretly, you know, the tiffin boxes, they're like these metal lunch boxes.
Sort of compartmentalized.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So she had seven brothers. So instead of keeping food in them, they would help her secretly put bells and her dance uniform and costume, and then she would cover up the tiffin box and go to school in her school uniform. And then after that, her brothers would escort her to the dance class, and then she'd come back in her school uniform. So she wouldn't have eaten all day, except her brothers would kind of share food with her. And that was her secret, really.
Let's have some music, Akram. What's next? We're on your third.
Anandodhara. The lyrics are by Rabindranath Tagore, but the song is orchestrated by Zoe and Idris Rahman. It's a song my mother used to sing when I was a child. And so when I heard this song, this new modern version, it just reminded me of my childhood with my mother. I was very fragile as a child and my mother would sing me this song to sleep. But just her voice singing this song always made me feel I had some kind of security blanket.
Uh, That was Anondo Dara, Stream of Joy by Zoe and Idris Rahman. There's a wonderful little family video of you, Akram Khan, dancing when you're very, very, very young. Do you know the video I'm talking about?
Yes.
Unfortunately. How old would you have been?
I can't remember. I think I was six.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you remember that?
I would lie if I said I could.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
I can remember moments of it. I can't remember the whole experience of it.
What about the experience of watching people watch you? What did that feel like? Because you said, you know, you were quite a timid little boy and a shy boy and a bit insecure. What was it like to be holding people's attention in the centre of the room?
It was great. I mean, you know, it's like being allowed to speak for the first time after however many years. Finding the language that you can speak in and people taking notice of that. It's such a uplifting feeling. And suddenly the insecurity is immediately filled with confidence. And that's another problem, because then you want everyone's attention all the time. So every dinner party we went to, I said, "Mum, are they going to ask me to dance? Are they going to ask me to dance?" Like I was this little star. And my mum said, "Look, it's not really a dinner party. It's a funeral, son. We're here for a funeral. You can't dance." I said, "I will do a funeral dance then. I'll do a funeral dance. It will be Michael Jackson, but it'll be a funeral dance. Thriller." So it became an addiction.
And what about, did you have enough self-possession to think, this is what I'm going to do? Because as you say, growing up in a Bangladeshi community in London, where the sense was that there has to be a degree of, I mean, actually pretty high academic achievement. Did you think, I'll always dance, but I'll have to do something else? Or did you think, I am going to dance?
I'm a bit like a floating boat. And I kind of go wherever the wind and the river takes me. I'm not very courageous in some respects, and I'm very courageous in other respects. I was never courageous to say, I want to do this. I'm a dreamer, and that was my biggest problem as a child. I couldn't sit in front of a desk. But the second I danced, my attention lasted longer than a minute. And once I discovered dance, I felt like this was my language. This is what I know. However, then to commit to being a dancer as a career, no, I didn't have the courage, but it came later. Everything happens to me late. My sister is 4 years younger than me, and she was better than me at everything, and even dance. She was in my class for dance, and she was 4 years younger. What I had, my talent, which is very little, would be I never gave up, and I was super committed. If I loved doing something, I became obsessive about it. I became possessive about it. And so, in a sense, talent doesn't go very far. It is what it is. You can't grow it. Hard work, you can continue to grow. And so, eventually, I surpassed my sister.
Now, how old exactly were you when you actually left home? I mean, properly left home.
Ah, this is embarrassing. I would say 32.
Right. Was that 31. Her making you stay, or you didn't want to leave your mother?
You know, my house is full of aunties and uncles. Aunties and uncles who are not even bloody related to me, you know? They're all just family friends. And they sit in these sofas. I mean, we even know which auntie sits on which part of the sofa because there's a dent there, because they stay there for hours and hours gossiping. Farouk, my producer, Farouk Chaudhry, who's my close collaborator, we started the company. He's the producer, I'm the artistic director, and we started it together. And ever since the company started, I went on tour. And once I went on tour, you know, after a long journey, say, for example, from Australia, you don't want to come home to a house full of aunties and uncles. And they say, "Oh, beta, come here and play tabla with us. You know, we want to sing tonight all night." I had to sit through 3 hours or 4 hours at night after traveling for 23 hours. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And I said, "Mum, I'm leaving." So the neighbors, our next door neighbors, were leaving. And my father said, "Why don't you buy the house next door? You know, we can break down the wall and put a door there. Anytime you want tea, I can just come in." I don't know why I'm doing this accent, but anyway. So that was that. And I said, "No, Dad, I'm moving at least one street away." So I moved one street away.
Let's have some music then. What are we going to hear now?
It's a group called Afileta, and it's "You Lamento de Gesso." I'm probably saying it wrong. Spiritual songs have always attracted me for some reason. What's beautiful about the song is that in between the verses is where the spirituality lies.
Affiletta and U Lamento di Gesù. So you were 10 years old then, Akram Khan, when the director, Peter Brook, spotted you. You ended up being in his production of the Mahabharata for 2 years. Pretty giddying experience, I imagine.
Yeah, it was great. I think it was 10 when I got chosen, but right. I was 13.
When you were touring?
When we started to rehearse in tour, yeah.
And so you were touring all around the world. I mean, you were in LA, Adelaide, Paris, Tokyo, New York. Was that constantly for 2 years you were on the road?
Almost, yeah. Right. We had breaks, but it was pretty heavy. And it's a 9-hour play. So it was quite intense for a kid, you know, and for them, I'm sure, for everyone involved.
How often did you see your parents then?
There was a condition that they allowed my parents to come, one of them, every 2 months or something. So they would spend a few weeks with us.
Right. Did you miss them?
No. No. It's amazing because I'm really a mummy's boy. My mother used to walk me to school until 13. She was afraid that I was very fragile. And funnily enough, once I went on tour, I didn't miss them at all. And I miss them now. I mean, they're still alive, but I miss every moment that I'm not with them. They are my parents, but slowly this transformation is happening where I'm becoming their parents. And I want to fulfill it in the best possible way I can.
What about this idea? It's the second time, I think, you've used the word fragile to describe yourself as a little boy. Your mother walking you to school up to the age of 13, that's really unusual. Did she think you were emotionally fragile? I mean, you couldn't have been physically fragile. You were.
Put it this way, I think my mother was fragile in some ways and very strong at the same time. She found it hard to let go of me.
Right.
Of course I was fragile because I didn't have many friends. So it was really extreme. You know, in school, I was very shy. Second, I'm on stage in front of hundreds of people. I'm completely shyless. So it's two extremes of my personality as a child.
And did you feel separate? Were you a little boy who felt apart from what was going on around you?
Yeah, I did. I did for quite a long time. You know, being a dancer also, it's funny because my mother was a great encouragement. She just said, usually what people find difficult is your strength. Her voice stayed with me and still stays with me.
Let's have some more music, Akram Khan. What are we going to hear now? We're on your fifth disc.
Prince, Sign of the Times. Mm. When I just finished the Mahabharata and I came back to London and I discovered Prince. And for me, Prince was very rebellious. He never wanted to conform. And I was going through that rebellious stage. And so Sign of the Times, I like very much because of the words, but I think Prince is a great example of not conforming.
In France, a skinny man died of a big disease with a little name. By chance, his girlfriend came across a needle and soon she did the same. At home, there were 17-year-old boys and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun.
That was Prince and Sign of the Times. You said to me a while ago that, you know, you can express yourself much more articulately through dance than you can. I mean, you're clearly a very articulate person, but you find that that's the most comfortable way to express yourself is through dance.
It's the most truthful way for me.
Yes. I'm thinking now of there was a production that you did called Desh, which was about your father's homeland, and your father came to see that. What were you trying to articulate, and do you think he got it?
No, he didn't get it, I think. My dad's an interesting character. I mean, he sees everything through what relates to him. So that's okay. That's interesting. My mother's the exact opposite. She sees the world from your perspective. And I think I have more of my father, which is a real problem. I want to be more of my mother, but I think I end up being more of my father. And I think he was a bit sad when he saw the show, because in the beginning of the show, I'm by his, you know, his burial, and he was a bit disappointed, like, you know, this, oh God, I'm dead already, so where do I exist in this piece? You know, I thought I was the star. By the end, he realized it was about him. So he got it, but not the way I wanted him to get it. It's not about just him, it's about what he wants his children to have. And I think that's what they fear the most somehow, and desire the most, is that will our children carry a part of their, you know, their memories? And that means a lot to them because I feel they're quite isolated. When they moved over in the early 70s, they brought with them a memory. And they brought that and they implanted it in London and they stayed inside that memory, that world. So the community were very self-preserved. And now when they go back to Bangladesh, they're kind of, you know, somebody's tripped them up. That's what it feels like, because it's an MTV world now in Bangladesh. Mm. It's an MTV world in India. It's not the same that it was in the 70s. The same value systems aren't there. The same pace of life is not there. It's moved on. But they really thought that it was going to be the same. And so in a sense, they're between two worlds. I think a lot of my work is drawn from my experience with my family.
And what does your father particularly make of that?
He doesn't really care. He just wants newspapers. My poor office is inundated with my father calling up every once a week, usually. He stopped now because I had to really ask him to stop. But he'd call up once a week and said, "Have you sent that recent copy of The Guardian?" And, you know, the office has so much to do.
And when he's reading The Guardian and reading your reviews in The Guardian, which I assume he does, does he care about that? Does he praise you for being a dancer of world renown?
No, he doesn't praise me at all. Mm. I love that about him. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing, good thing about him. He never praises me to myself. It's amazing. I walk off the stage and I, you know, Sadler's Wells, and there's loads of people and they say, "Oh, I met your father." They all know my father. He just talks to everyone there and says, "This is my son. He's going to perform. I'm his father. So my father, in a sense, in a beautiful way, but also in a tragic way, lives his dreams through me. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. Let's have some music then. We're on your sixth choice.
You know, I was born and brought up in London, southwest London. London's a very special place because it's chaotic. It's full of so many different cultures, energies, different languages. You really have to be on another gear. And this is the only music that brings me down to tranquility. And it was also my wedding song.
Part of Arvo Pärt Spiegel im Spiegel, performed by Vadim Glutzmann and Angela Joffe, and you said that was your wedding song.
It was, yeah.
Must have been a very gentle wedding with that music.
Yeah, it was chosen both by my wife and myself, yeah. We always feel very tranquil when we hear this song.
You've collaborated, I said in the introduction, you sort of almost seem to be a compulsive collaborator. Some very interesting people, probably not unexpectedly, Sylvie Guillaume, the prima ballerina, but also you choreographed a piece called In I with Juliette Binoche, the Oscar-winning actress, obviously not a dancer.
Yeah.
A difficult process?
It was very challenging, yes, in all honesty.
That covers a multitude, doesn't it? Very challenging.
We learnt a lot, both of us. We're very strong-headed people. She's very, very strong and determined, and so am I. And we had different ways of looking at the work because we come from different backgrounds. So we both compromise. But collaboration is always compromise. A marriage is a compromise, but it's a compromise by choice because you know you want that.
And what about moving from the more avant-garde to the populist? I'm thinking now, you choreographed part of Kylie Minogue's Showgirl tour. How did that go?
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Because when you choreograph a piece of work, in all honesty, I've never experienced labour pain, giving birth to a child. From what women tell me, I feel it's the same thing. And then the child is born, your piece is born, and then the crying starts. And you realise the work has huge problems and the audience are crying and the critics are writing. And, you know, you realise yourself that there's a
this is not over yet. This is just the beginning. So Kylie's project was a heaven. I really liked her as a person. She was everything that I didn't expect. She was not a diva at all. She was very human and very simple in many ways, but in a beautiful way.
Time for some more music, Akram Khan. What are we going to hear now? Seventh choice.
Left field. There's nothing profound about this music. If I'm really tired in the morning and I know I have to go and do the same warm-up, this is the only music. It's like a bit like equivalent to Rocky for men who go to the gym. Well, my assumption is they're listening to Rocky, you know, the theme tune. So this is my version of Rocky.
That was Left Field and Fat Planet. You live a street away then now from your parents. A whole street away you've managed to live. Do you think, are you a difficult person to live with?
You have to ask my wife about that.
What do you think she'd say if I did?
I am. Yeah, I think she would say I am. No, I am difficult. I'm just working all the time. It's very hard for me to switch off from work. Mm. But my wife is great. She's Japanese in the best sense. She knows when I have to switch off, and she will make me switch off, trust me.
Right.
So it's great because it allows me to breathe. So my wife is a great saviour, but I'm difficult to live with, of course I am.
And is she a dancer too? Is she involved in the same industry?
She's a Kathak dancer. She's stopped now, but she's a wonderful Kathak dancer. I was mentoring her, actually.
Right. And so you don't have children yet. Does your life sort of revolve around dance? Do you wake up thinking about it? Do you go to sleep at night thinking about it? Do you wake up in the middle of the night thinking about it?
No, I wake up thinking about my wife. I go to sleep thinking about my wife. During the day, I think about my work.
That seems about the right balance.
Yeah.
So I'm going to send you then to this island, and you will be alone. How on earth will you cope alone? Do you think you'd be good with your own company?
No. No, I don't think I would. I'm terrified of being alone. I'm terrified of confronting myself. I think that's the one thing I'm very terrified of.
Why is that?
I don't know. I've always been. I can be alone for about an hour. But longer than that, I need to communicate. I need to... I'm okay when I'm dancing. I can practice in a studio for hours and hours. I suppose if I'm on the island, if you give me a dance floor, I'll be fine, because I'll have my companion is my dance.
Let's have your final choice then, Akram. What are we going to hear?
It's by Gavin Bryars. Jesus' Blood Has Never Failed Me. This is a very profound song, I have to say. It was Gavin Bryars who recorded this homeless man, and I come predominantly from the classical world. We're always trying to achieve perfection in the classical world. But by hearing this song, I realised the power of imperfection. He doesn't sing in perfect tune, but there's a truth. His words have weight because he's living it. He's lived it. And it's coming from a very deep place. And this song really reflects that moment of me being awakened to the power of imperfection.
Jesus' blood never failed me yet. Never failed me yet. Jesus' blood never failed me yet. This one thing I know, for he loved me so. Jesus' blood never failed me yet.
That was Gavin Bryars and Jesus' Blood Never Failed Me Yet. So we come to the moment now, Akram Khan, where I'm going to give you the books. Traditionally, it's the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. Would you prefer the Quran or would you like the Bible?
I'd love the Quran, yeah.
Okay, so the Quran, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you also get to take a book of your own along to the island. What book would you like to take?
Can I say two? No, one.
No, it's got to be one.
We're collaborating here. I'm trying to come.
Well, I can collaboratively reveal that you will not get to take two.
One, it'll probably be Arundhati Roy, God of Small Things.
Indeed, we shall give you that. And a luxury, too. You're allowed something on this island that makes life just a little bit more bearable. What would you take as your luxury?
I would probably take my skipping rope.
Ah, not your bells, I wonder.
No. No. Okay. I think my skipping rope has been my saviour recently.
Okay.
Not my bells.
Right. We shall allow you the skipping rope then. And if you had to save just one of the eight discs from the waves, which one would you pick?
Avopart.
Okay. It's yours, Akram Khan. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.